Welcome to the Be Good podcast, where we explore the application of behavioral economics for good in order to nudge better business and better lives.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Be Good, brought to you by BVNH Consulting, a global consultancy specializing in the application of behavioral science for successful behavior change. Every month, we get to speak with a leader in the field of behavioral science, psychology, neuroscience, and related science in order to get to know more about them, their work, and its application to emerging issues. My name is Eric Singler, founder and CEO of BVNH Consulting. I am delighted to be introducing our guest today, Dan Ariely. Dan is a James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University. He is also a founding member of the Center for Advanced Insights. But many of you will first have known Dan from hearing his writing. He is the author of several best-selling books, including Predictably Irrational and 2008, which was one of the first books to bring behavioral science to the mainstream discourse, and certainly the most important one with Nudge. He followed that up with The Upside of Irrationality, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, Irrationally Yours, Payoff, Dollars and Cents, Amazing Decision. Dan has also recorded several TED Talks with 27 million views. Dan, it's a great personal pleasure to have you here today. I met Dan close to 15 years ago at Duke University. Since then, I have been fortunate enough to regularly meet Dan and, of course, to listen to read, watch all of his works. I have to tell you and to tell our listeners that I consider myself as a friend of Dan. Dan was extremely kind to be the first guest on my podcast, Be Good, in March 2020. And I am more than delighted he has agreed to participate again to discuss his new book, published last September, Misbelief, What Makes Rational People Believe Irrational Things. So, welcome Dan, and a huge thank you for being with us. So Dan, I would like to begin by talking about the genesis of this new book. As I mentioned earlier, I have read all of your books, and I believe I can say that this one is the most personal. Could you tell us how the idea of working on the subject of misbelief came about? Maybe more specifically, what happened in your personal life during the COVID period that made you want to better understand this phenomenon?
This book was very different. So this was the beginning of 2020. We were all very busy with COVID. You were helping governments. I was helping governments. I basically stopped everything, and I was just working on COVID-related issues. And of course, I'm not a biologist, so. But it was about how do we do distant education and distant work? And how does the government give money to people? And do we do fines for people who violate the rules? How do we encourage new habits? What do we do with releasing prisoners? Lots of questions. And I felt I was at the top of my academic profession. I felt I was being the most helpful I could be. And a few months into COVID, almost half a year into it, I get an email. And the email said, Dan, what happened to you? How have you become that person? And this was from somebody I once met and actually helped once. And I write back and I say, what do you mean? What happened to me? And she sent me a long list of links that all tell terrible stories about me. I'll give you just one as an example. In that link, there was a video that described how I was badly burned many years ago, which is true. How I spent 3 years in hospital, almost 3 years in hospital, also true. And how because of that, I started hating healthy people. Not true. and how, because of that, I joined the cabal, Bill Gates and the Illuminati to try and kill as many healthy people as possible. Also not true. This was, by the way, before there was a vaccine, but they already predicted that the vaccine is going to kill lots of people. Anyway, it was terrible to see all of those things. And my immediate instinct was to say, these people got it wrong. Let me fix it. So I called some of them up. I invited some of them to come and meet me. I joined Zoom calls and Telegram and you all kinds of things. And I had a terrible month. I had a terrible month because I almost didn't get to convince anybody. And instead, I just got more people mad at me. And I had a very tough month. I started getting death threats. By the way, now we're, you know, in the beginning of 2024. Just recently, my university got a death threat that frightened them so much that they had to refer it to the authority. So, you know, the very, very, very tough, painful, dark, troubling. I had a hard time focusing. I had a hard time sleeping. It was a very, very tough period. But after about a month of trying to fight it, I realized it's a losing proposition. And instead, I felt compelled to study it. And for two reasons. One is that imagine somebody that is telling you, Eric, why did you, why were you so rude to your coworkers yesterday? And you say, I didn't even meet my coworkers yesterday. So like we all know that people believe all kinds of strange things. The earth is flat, you name it. But when somebody tells you that they're expert on your life, they know things about you better than what you know about yourself, that's very eerie. It's very, very troubling, very, very difficult. And I felt compelled to study it. I also was attacked by these very, very strange forces, and I felt compelled to try and understand it. So I spent basically the next 2 years in all kinds of dens of misinformation, all kinds of dark corners of the internet, all kinds of things, trying to understand it. And this book eventually is a book that describes the psychology of what I call the funnel of misbelief. And I give the cookie as a metaphor. Like a cookie is a weaponized food that is designed to get people to eat one and then to eat more. And it's a perfect combination of sugar, fat, and salt to get us to crave one and then another one, another one, another one. The funnel of misbelief attacks almost all of our psychology, right? It starts with emotion and stress. It continues with cognition, with personality, with social elements, and it's basically, I don't think anybody designed it, but with all kinds of pressures, we designed the machinery that takes us and basically gets us to go down into this funnel of misbelief. And in the beginning, I was very angry with these people. But through this process, I got to have much more empathy for them. And I realized that we shouldn't discount the people who have these beliefs, and we should discount those beliefs. And what I mean by that is that those beliefs answer a real need that people have. Like if we just say, oh, these people are crazy, we're not going to go forward. But what we need to understand is what were the psychological needs that got fulfilled by these misbeliefs? What was the process? What does it do for them? Now, I'm not saying it's a healthy process. It's a bit like a mosquito bite, right? You have a mosquito bite, you have a need to itch. Then you itch, it gets worse and worse. But the need to itch is a real need. It's not a healthy need, but it's a real need. And in the same way, some of those beliefs and some of the ways people communicate online and show identity politics and so on, are things that we need to understand psychologically if we want to fight them. So nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I want to believe that the government is planting G5 in order to control my mind. Nobody wants to believe that. But people have some needs, and then these things emerge. And we'll talk about the funnel of misbelief, but the big picture, of course, is that this phenomena of misinformation and misbelief is larger and more frightening than I thought. When I started writing the book, I told my publisher that I'll have a chapter on solutions. I ended up not having a chapter on solution. I ended up having little sections called Hopefully Helpful. Yeah. But I do think that it's one of the biggest challenges of our time. And, you know, the book came out before the war between Israel and Hamas. The book came out before we saw what's happening. I finished writing it before we knew Trump is going to run for president. If you think about 10 years ago, and imagine 10 years ago, we made a list of all the things that we thought are challenges for humanity for moving forward, I don't think that misinformation and misbelief would have been one of the top five, so maybe not even the top 10. I think now it's a major issue. If you ask the question, how can we move forward on anything that we need to move forward together, we have to have a shared understanding. And our shared understanding is so minimal now. We separate on everything. How can we move forward? How can we move forward as countries, as nations, as the world? So I think we have to figure it out. It's going to be difficult and painful. It will involve lots of regulations and social media, and it will take some time. But the more I look into it, the more I think that the problem is urgent and we need to do something about it. Mm.
Dan, before we go into the detail of each of your four steps, I would like to also ask a question about your approach. Because for this book, you used an approach that seems original to me. Of course, as usual, you relied on the results on numerous scientific experiments, but you also interviewed and met many misbelievers. Could you explain to us why you made this kind of methodological choice?
Yes. So first of all, it's absolutely true. You know, when I was younger in my academic career, I thought that the only way to do research is to do randomized controlled trials. And then, of course, I matured and became a little softer. And now I think that there are many ways to gain data. We recently, for example, interviewed death doulas. Death doulas are the people that escort people through the last stages of their lives. And we asked them what they think is a good death. And, you know, I'm not an expert in interviewing, but, you know, that they're experts in the end of life and they know something about it. So there were two reasons for this approach, and I became more of an anthropologist in this case than a psychologist. So I can't help. I'm a psychologist, but I bring psychology into the picture because these are the tools that I come to look at things. But eventually, I became more of an anthropologist. And the reason is that it's a very unique population. It's a very unique population. And doing a survey on them, first of all, it's not going to work. I spend a tremendous amount of money trying to get misbelievers both on Reddit and on some website of some conspiracy theorists to come and submit to fill surveys. They don't do it, of course. But the reality is that, you know, it's a very deep phenomenon. It's a very deep phenomenon. And to understand it fully, you have to meet the people who are engaged in it. And I don't even know if I could have created, I can create a survey for something specific. Like I could create a survey of whether need for cognition influences misbelief. But to understand the nuances of what was happening in people's lives and how do they get to where they are, you need kind of the unfolding of the story. And it's going to be different. So, for example, one of the women who came to talk to me was a teacher. She was an art teacher. And when COVID started, she was one of the very few that lost her job. And the reason was technical. She had a different contract than other teachers, and she lost her job. Like, most teachers were on a different contract than her. And she lost her job. And she lost her apartment. And she went to live in her car. And you, when she described that, the stress was amazing, right? Why me and not other people? Why did I lose my apartment? Other people don't. The fact that she had to move to her car was inconceivable to her. She kept on repeating it. And because of this stress she felt, the stress of feeling hard done by, feeling like the world is treating her unfairly, everybody else, you know, other teachers were working from home, less hours, all kinds of things like that. She felt they were better off and she was worse off. That created a deep need to try and understand the world. And she went the path of misbelief. Now, everybody has their own story, their own trigger, their own beginning point. So this process of getting to know a few people in a deep way and then relying on research for other things, I think was the right fit for that. I think that now, after understanding the foundation of this, I could have more specific questions and dive into them in a more, if I could get people to do surveys, then I could more deeply dive into it. But at that point, it was too early.
Okay. Dan, I would like us now to delve into the description of each of the stages, if I could call it like that, of this funnel of misbelief. You talk about the role of, as a starting point, of emotion, pressure, and specifically you mentioned that the starting condition and most basic ingredient is stress. Can you explain the role of stress and maybe in particular the impact of what you call unpredictable stress on our cognitive boundaries?
Yeah. So in the same way that, so let's just name all the elements. The start to descent into misbelief starts with emotion and stress, this unpredictable stress. Then it has a component of cognition, personality, and the thing that kind of seals the deal is the social element. Now, why is it that when we have stress, and particularly unpredictable stress, we go down the funnel of misbelief? So sometimes we use stress by saying, wow, I'm so busy, I don't know how I'll be able to handle all my email. That's not the stress we mean. We mean the stress like the art teacher I told you about. We mean stress of people saying, I don't understand the world. Why am I sick and other people are not? What is happening with this strange virus? By the way, now I think we're in a period of very high stress. I hear students worried about ChatGPT and saying, will I get a job? What will replace me? Where is the world going? What is this war in Ukraine? What happened with Yemen? Why are the Yemenis attacking ships? You know, like the amount of stress is very high. And by the way, what we care about is not just the stress coming in, but also the resilience we have to protect against it. And we can talk about it, but resilience is at the all-time low. So not only do we have more stress, but resilience is at an all-time low. So think about two examples. Imagine two tribes of fishermen. One tribe of fishermen fishes in the ocean, another one fishes in a lake. Which one has a more unpredictable environment? Of course, the one in the ocean. Storms, currents, all kinds of things happen. Which one of them is more likely to develop superstitions? The one in the ocean. Why? Because when things are unpredictable, we're looking for a story. We're looking to explain things. So when people have something bad happen to them, We need a story. We need to feel in control. And not only do we need a story with a villain, right? It's not like the fish, but if something bad happened to me, I lost my job when other people didn't, I'm looking for a story with the villain. I don't want to feel guilty myself. I'm looking for a story with the villain. And not only that, I'm looking for a complex story. Now, that's a little strange because we all think that people usually love simple story. Why the complex? Because the complex story maintains continuous engagement, more details to be found out. So, for example, the story about me. Recently, there was a video connecting me to the atrocities of October 7th. You know, they like new things are happening, right? There's new ways to create it. But it also gives people a sense of superiority. I know something that you don't. You're looking down at me. You think I lost my job. I live in my car. But I actually understand the world in a better way than you do. It's a way to reverse inferiority into superiority. So the stress is the necessary condition. If people are happy and stress-free, they're not going to start believing in all kinds of things. But stress, low resilience, get people to start looking for answers. They're looking for a story. They're looking for a villain. They're looking for something complex. Internet as we have it now makes it very easy to find one of those, and they find it. And every time they look at it, they feel slightly relieved. So I feel bad about myself. I don't know what's going on. Why am I suffering this way? Oh, I found the villain. I feel slightly happier now, slightly not happier. I feel that I understand the world. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. But then, of course, in the long term, I feel the world is a darker place. And then I say, oh, the world is a darker place. Let me find a villain, a little happier. The world is darker. So that's the beginning of that path. Now, the cognition part is quite clear. So first of all, there's a whole range of media that we could watch. We don't watch all of it. Each of us decide what we're going to listen to. We decide about which part, and we only go for that part. So that's confirmation bias. We listen to the media that we're comfortable with. Then we have some more interesting things, which is there's a way for us to bend the what we listen to. So we can listen to lots of things, but we discount the things we don't like and we emphasize the things that we like. Imagine that you listen to a news story that has two pieces of information that you don't like and one that you like. You know, you'll discount the one that you don't like and you'll pay attention to the one you like. And we call this motivated reasoning, right? It's not just the exposure. It's also that we're able to bend reality. And there's lots more to talk about that.
Yeah, you mentioned here our dysfunctional information processing machinery. Could you come back on how do our cognitive structure and maybe more generally the way we process information make us more susceptible to misinformation?
Yeah, so let's think about something that also has a suggestion within it. There's something called the illusion of explanatory depth. So I'll give you one demonstration I did for the illusion of explanatory depth. Is I went to people and I say, do you understand how a flush toilet works? One of those things that you do like this and the toilet flushes. And people say yes. And I say, how about on a scale from 1 to 7? Really good. Great. Luckily for you, I have all the pieces here for a flush toilet. Please assemble it. Nobody can assemble it. And when we finish the exercise of trying to assemble it and failing, I ask them, how well do you think you understand a flush toilet? And they say, not so much. Now, usually when we come to argue with people, we fight. Here's another data. It's a very strange process when you think about it. Like I have asked people, I didn't collect this data officially, but I've asked people, in the last 5 years, how many people have you convinced that they were wrong? How many people did you argue? And at the end of this, people said, you know what? I was completely wrong. I'm so sorry. How did I? And of course, then I ask people, how many times were you being completely wrong? And the reality is that when we think about this process, the reality is that when somebody argues with us, from the moment they start speaking, we stop listening and we start counter-arguing. In our mind, we are already coming up with how to defend against their attack and attack them back. And we think that we spend an hour where they listen to us and we listen to them, but the reality is we spend an hour thinking just about our side and how to defend and attack them, and they thought just about their side. So we don't get convinced. So the illusion of explanatory depth suggests something different. It says, don't argue with people, come from their side. So you know, I'm privileged. I have friends or people I know from all over the world. And after October 7th, I got lots of people who contacted me that wanted to talk about Israel, Hamas, Gaza. Of course, very, very tough topics, very painful. But I usually try to have the discussion in the following way. I say, look, I don't want to talk about historical accuracy. What exactly happened in 1948 and what exactly happened in 67 and so on. I just don't know enough. And I don't want to have this discussion. I'm unprepared for that. And I said, look, I also don't want to have a discussion about who is more morally wrong. I just don't see the value of trying to find moral relativism. There's lots of ways to do it. I don't see a point. I do want to talk about what do we do next. I do want to talk about what do we do next. We're all here to try and improve the world. Let's talk about what's next. And I say to people, okay, you tell me. Again, I don't argue. I say, you tell me, what do you want? And in the last many discussions I had on this, people say, we want an immediate ceasefire. And I say, of course, I'm in no official capacity to grant it, but let's say I would grant you an immediate ceasefire. What now? And then they mostly say, we want the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, to leave Gaza. Okay, again, I can't do it, but let's say I would give it to you. And I say, and what's next? And usually they say, no, that's the end. I say, no, that's not the end. It can't possibly be the end. I said, what do we do now? Do we let Hamas continue ruling Gaza? And they say, of course, they were democratically elected. Until the next election, they should rule back. I said, okay. And I said, then what next? I said, what do you mean? I said, do we let them arm again? And they say, of course, they are the elected government of Gaza. And then I say, do we allow them to have a nuclear weapon? And they say, well, maybe not. I say, what about an air force? What about the navy? What happened in October 7th happens again in 3 months? What do we do next? And, you know, this is not arguing. This is basically floating the complexities. And I think, you know, like all human tragedy, this is an incredibly complex, difficult one. By the way, when they say we don't know, I also don't know. Like, and then we say, okay, so let's think about what do we do? What can we do? What would we propose? So the illusion of explanatory depth is basically about, let's stop fighting. You know, it looks to me like people are behaving as if we're in a court. Like they're on Twitter and they pretend there's a judge and everybody's in court stating their position. Sometimes people are in court, but mostly we have discussions to get to a mutual understanding, for both of us to understand the world a better way and then come up with some directions. By the way, this is what saddens me so much about what's happening in American university.
Yeah, I saw your recent post on Instagram and other social media.
Yeah, so but you know, you asked the question of what's the role of universities. The role of universities is to propose, to teach and to gain data and to propose better ways for the world to move forward. Like I would have loved for universities to say, you know what, we have students that believe very different things. Please get together and propose solutions. Like, you know, if universities fight and they result to people hurting each other, what's the hope? These are people who are far away from the conflict in a beautiful environment of a campus. And if they end up fighting, where's the hope for humanity? Like, well, what we should have done is to say to all universities, you disagree, that's great. You'll have lots of disagreements in your life. This is a good opportunity. Like, let's stop all teaching on campus if you want. And just try to come up with a proposal. Like, imagine Harvard University would basically say, we're going to lead the world in coming up with possible creative solution. Now, would Hamas accept their solution? Would the Israeli? I don't know. But that would have been such a better leadership than to basically say, let's show you how we can fight on campus. Anyway, that's a separate story. But the illusion of explanatory depth is saying arguments are unhelpful, our cognitive structure is not listening, and we're not persuaded. And what we really need to do is to realize that our confidence and our knowledge are very different. We need to reduce our confidence to closer to the level of our knowledge. And then we're able to start noticing complexities and maybe come up with some direction.
Yeah, it is a second step of this funnel of myths, belief. And you talk also, and it is maybe the third step, about the role of personalities. Yes. Because not everyone falls into this funnel. So according to you, what personality traits predispose and are correlated with misbelief?
Yes. So first of all, I want to make a word of caution about personality. If you're high on that personality, it doesn't mean you'll become a misbeliever. And if you're not, it doesn't mean you're immune. It just makes it slightly less. So if we think about stress as the driving force, if you have the right personality, you need a little bit less stress to move forward, right? If you think about it, like lubricates the road. If you have this personality. So what are the personalities? So first of all, people who are more sensitive to stress take stress in a different way. In particular, it's very interesting, there's a trait of narcissism. And of course, there are people who are extreme on narcissism. I'm not talking about extreme. I'm talking about people who are slightly more narcissists than others. Narcissists love when the world tells them that they are wonderful. And when this kind of stress happens, narcissists take it extra badly. Like, imagine again that teacher that we described. Imagine that she was slight narcissist. She would take that pressure of why me and not other people, as the world is not recognizing how wonderful I am. So she takes that worse. Another example is people who connect the dots. Right? I was on one interview and I mentioned that we worked on vaccines. I was in a different interview and I mentioned that we worked with the Gates Foundation on childhood nutrition in Africa. You know, somebody connected the dots, Gates, vaccines, and here was the story and other things like that. So people who are creative come up sometimes with more creative seeing the dots in different ways. Another one is the personality trait of trusting our intuitions. You know, some people just trust themselves, like I'm a good judge of character and so on. And when we see a video, the question is, what's our first instinct? To doubt it or to trust it? Now, trust is a beautiful thing. Not if it's being abused. Not by this machinery. So there are lots of attributes like that. We had a very large study on lots and lots of personality traits. and we looked at which one of them matters and not, and lots of them end up mattering. But I want to focus the rest of our time on the social element, because I think it's one of the biggest, and certainly something that is more and more in our focus of attention these days. So when we think about the social element, we're not just thinking social media. Think about the social element. And the first component is what is called ostracism. And ostracism is the idea that rejection feels very badly. A ton of experiments on rejection, and it turns out that when people feel socially rejected, almost everything good about humanity gets worse. People are less collaborative and give less to charity and help less and feel worse and less optimistic. Almost everything good becomes worse. If there are three people, you, me, and another friend, and the three of us are tossing a ball or talking, and all of a sudden the two of you are ignoring me and start just talking or tossing the ball between the two of you, lots of things get worse. Lots of things get worse. And we all have to admit that when it comes to people with different beliefs, we all have a very hard time not ostracizing them. So take a very complex moral question like attitude toward abortions. You know, people have very strong opinions about this, right? Very few people are on the border. Most people have strong opinions. Imagine that somebody that you know from childhood, and you always thought that you see the world in a similar way, came to you now with a complete opposite view. It's very hard not to look at them and think that they are broken. How can you and I grow in the same environment, see things in the same way? I always thought we saw it now. Like, what's broken? How can it be that you believe that thing? And under those conditions, it's very hard to respect those people. Now, I think we need to. But eventually, we live in the same country. We have to make a decision together and so on. We have to accept. It's okay to try and convince. But what we don't just try to convince, we look at those people as sub something, right? They're not performing well. So now the question is how do we get to a better state? But the moment we ostracize them, these people feel very bad. And by the way, we can ostracize them a little bit, and they would feel very bad. Like if you think about somebody who is just starting to explore some misbelief. Somebody comes to you and say, "What, Eric, I just saw this video on aliens. I start to believe that maybe the U.S. government, you know, whatever they say." You know, you would probably make a little bit fun of them, and they will take it as a big offense. So we push people away, and I think we push people away in a bigger way than we imagine. And then people need to find a home. And again, the internet gets you to find a home to almost any belief that you have. And in that home, you would feel welcome and loved. But it doesn't stop here, because if you really want to feel welcome and loved, you have to be extreme. You have to say things that are more extreme. And here's a place where another thing comes to play, which is what we call shibboleth. And shibboleth is a term from the Bible. And the story is that there were these two tribes that were in a war. And after the war, they settled on two sides of the river. Now imagine that we settle on two sides of the river. You walk around, you meet people. You don't know if they are from your tribe or the other tribe. This plant, shibboleth, the two tribes happened to pronounce it differently. One of them said shibboleth, and one of them said sibboleth. So imagine I meet you. I don't know if you're my tribe or not. I show you the plant and I say, "How do you call this plant?" If you say it the way I said it, great. We are from the same tribe. We hug. If you say it the way the other tribe say it, "Oh, now you're my enemy. I need to chase you to chase you away. Now, if you think about it, when I show you the plant and ask you what's the name of this plant, I don't care about the name of the plant. I'm asking you to say something about your identity. And we now use this term shibboleth to indicate cases where people might think that we're talking to the point. People might think that we're talking about the name of the plant, but no, we're actually signaling identity. And if you look at the discourse online, you can recognize lots of those things. there was a study in the US about people who shout to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. And they asked them from what river to what sea. And many of them don't know. Now when they're saying this phrase from the river to the sea, obviously if they don't know, they don't really mean it. They're shouting something about identity. They're saying, I belong to a group of these friends who are pained about injustice of minorities in the world. Like they have a statement that signals some identity, but it's not really that they mean what they say. In the case of Fox News, for example, when they said that Trump won the last election, now we know because of the lawsuit that they never meant it. They didn't mean it as Trump won the election. They meant to say, look what strong Trump supporters we are. We are such Trump supporters. If we said something like everybody else, it wouldn't show our identity. But we're saying something so extreme that's showing our identity. And of course, when speech becomes not about speech, it becomes about identity and we don't know what it is, it's very, very tough. It's very, very tough. And then there's the last component of the social element, which is cognitive dissonance. And everybody knows cognitive dissonance, but just to kind of go back to the original story from Festinger, there was this woman who predicted that the world would end, destroyed, and only she and her followers will be saved by aliens. And they would come on a specific date and save them, and then the world would be destroyed. And Festinger was wondering what would happen to her followers. So for simplicity, imagine two types of followers. Die-hard followers, people who left home and sold their properties and said goodbye to everybody and so on. And on-the-fence followers, people who don't really think it will happen, but they're there just in case. Which one would be more disappointed? And you could imagine that the people who really trusted her would be more disappointed. But Festinger, and they would go home, but Festinger predicted the opposite. He said that the people who invested so much in her, the people who gave their property and sold everything and said goodbye and so on, would experience a dissonance. I did all of this work. It looks like she's fake. Now, they can't change all the work they've done. So they will say, oh, she's actually our savior. And that's what they did. The next day when they woke up, they said, oh my goodness, she's the person who saved us, right? And the people who were on the fence said, turns out she's not, let's go home. So cognitive dissonance is all about the idea that once we behave in a certain way, our preferences follow. We usually think that we have preferences and we act on those preferences. But what it also means is when we act, our preferences get more in line with that. So for example, if you think about what happens to somebody who was, a COVID denier for 2 years that demonstrates against injections and all kinds of things, what happens to them afterward? Can they just say, oh, it turns out it was wrong? Or are these 2 years so salient, they've acted so much in that direction that they can't give it up? And that's actually what you see. You see a lot of those people have turned into climate deniers. A lot of them are not vaccinating for other things, alternative treatment to cancer. all kinds of things. And similar, if you think about, imagine a U.S. student who did not hear much about Israel, Gaza, Hamas, Palestinians. And imagine that now they go to campus and they join a demonstration. And maybe they take away some sign and do some actions. What happens after this demonstration? Are they the same person? According to cognitive dissonance, not so much. Now they've acted in a certain way, and now they've strengthened their preferences in that way. So anyway, so cognitive dissonance basically gets people through their actions to make it much, much harder to escape this path. Anyway, so that's the funnel of misbelief. And as we said, the big envelope of all of this is mistrust. Because misbelief has two components. It has the component of believing in something that is ain't so, and it has the component of making that a central way of looking at life. So, you know, you could say, what's the least harmful conspiracy theory? And you could say, maybe that the earth is flat. Why is it not very harmful? Because if you believe the earth is flat, you're not changing the shape of the earth. If you believe that there's no COVID, you might act in a more risky way. But if you believe the earth is flat, what are you going to do? You can't protest. But that's not true, because if you believe the earth is flat, it doesn't end there. You believe that NASA is lying to you, and the government is lying to you, and every government is lying, and they're all in it together. And every pilot knows the truth, and there's no satellites. And it's not just about the earth is flat. It's about a perspective on life in which you say, there is a bigger story here. I don't know what it is, but they're all hiding it. And what else they're hiding? What else they're hiding? And because of that, it's a gateway for more and more misbelief and less trust.
Dan, we are at the end of this conversation, and I would like to ask you two more questions. At the end of the book, you say this following question: sadly, in my view, the damaging effect of the funnel of misbelief are not just going to disappear. In fact, they are going to gain more strength and momentum. And a little later, you express, nevertheless, your optimism by saying, I find hope in human beings, and explaining why Superman gives you this hope. Can you explain this pessimism regarding the development of misbelief, and also this hope?
Yeah, so I think that society in general is slowly descending in the wrong direction. I think we're descending in the wrong direction in terms of our social connections and our community, and we're descending in the wrong direction in terms of polarization and misinformation and the education system, you name it, lots of things. Those things are more convenient to create new technologies that abuse our human nature than to help us make better decisions. But my hope is that when we finally get our act together, we can act. Right? So the only question is, would we get our act together? And, you know, I can also, you can think about lots of tragedies. As things slower get worse and worse and worse, there's not a single day in which you say, we have to wake up and do something. But when we notice something in a big way, then we can wake up, right? So if you think about, I mean, we don't always do it, but if you think about what happened after the elections on Capitol Hill in the US, that should have been an event that got Americans to think, we have a real problem here with information. It got some people to think, but not to act enough. What we see now in terms of misinformation on social media is certainly get people to wake up for this. I think that we need to make it salient. We need to make it an issue. I would love politicians to run on the platform of shaping our information world to be more accurate and basically saying this is an important enough problem that I'm going to make it, first of all, a national, but hopefully an international priority. So the question is, when will it become a priority? But if it will become a priority, I think we can deal with it. I think it's, you know, in the short term, I think it's more devastating than global warming. And I think we need to solve it before we solve global warming. But I also think that if we decided to solve it, it's easier to solve than global warming. I think there are things we could do, not overnight and so on. But I think it's doable. So I see the deterioration and it worries me a lot. The question is, when will it catch ourselves? And I think that while I was hoping that the book would come up with solutions, I think that we have small solutions that we can implement. But the big thing is we need to wake up and we need to decide that that's a priority for the world, right? If you think about, you know, what do we want the world to look like in 3 years from now? I think we need to have less misinformation, less misbelief. There are things that we can do to tackle those. We just have to decide to do it.
Thank you so much again, Dan. I cannot finish this conversation without asking you, as I would say an Israeli living partially in Tel Aviv and also as a social scientist, what is your view on the war between Israel and the Hamas terrorists? And perhaps more importantly, do you see a resolution to this conflict so that people can live in peace and happiness in this region in the years to come?
So I sadly have only 1 minute. it's a long thing. I would say that I'm not sure that people can overcome deep religious differences. You know, the statement from the river to the sea from either side can't work. If the Israelis say we want from the river to the sea and the Palestinians say like there's only one river and one sea and there has to be a compromise. I think the question is how many people would die until we reach a compromise? You know, will it never happen and we'll keep on dying, or will it happen sooner or later? I think the two sides are too myopic and I don't think they can agree on anything. The question is, will there be a big enough third party or third parties who can force an agreement? It's one of those cases where I think the world has a responsibility. I think the world has the world has some challenges that are world challenges for the world. I think climate change is one of them. I think water is another one. Food supply is another one. And I think peace in the Middle East is another one. It's of course not just Israel and Hamas, right? We have Iran, we have Yemen, we have what's happening in Lebanon, in Syria. I mean, the region is troubled. And, you know, when a region is troubled, lots of bad things happen. And I think that the world needs to wake up and decide to help improve what's happening in the Middle East, and we have to. There's much more to say, but I sadly have to run a little late for my next meeting.
Thanks a lot, Dan, for your time. It was an insightful conversation as usual. Take care, and a big thank you again. Thanks, Dan.
Lovely to see you. Talk to you soon.
Be good. A podcast by the BVA Nudge Unit.